Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Today, we're talking about a very weird movie that I really, really liked. Annihilation is a film about fear. It's also about identity and grief and things that go bump in the night. It's inspired by, but quite different from, a 2014 novel by Jeff Vandermeer.
The movie has a strong cast, including Natalie Portman, Oscar Isaac, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Tessa Thompson, and Gina Rodriguez. It was written and directed by Alex Garland, who also made Ex Machina. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're diving into the substantial mysteries of the very unusual film Annihilation on this week's Pop Culture Happy Hour. You've already met Stephen Thompson of NPR Music. Also with us is our pal Chris Klimek. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Linda.
And with us from NPR member station WAMU right here in D.C., where she works on projects including The Big Listen, Daisy Rosario. Hi, Daisy.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have all of us here. We saw this film as we taped this last night. I want to know, Stephen, how did it strike you?
This is a lot of movies in one. You have a lot of disaster movie kind of contagion story going on. You have a picked off one by one horror movie. And there's so much going on. There's such a kind of onslaught of ideas that are still presented in this kind of lyrical and almost dreamy way that you really can't take your eyes off of it. It's a movie that stuck with me for quite a while. At one point, we had a brief break in the middle of our screening where they actually stopped the movie for a few minutes. And I went up and went to the restroom, and there was like a poster or something with like a picture of a tiger on it, and it freaked me out.
Yeah.
Like, this movie messes with your head.
Yeah. I think all we can really say about the plot of it is that it's almost like a Bermuda Triangle movie where there's this mysterious place, they call it the Shimmer, and there's this team that has to go in there and investigate and try to figure out what's going on. And the team includes Natalie Portman and Gina Rodriguez and Tessa Thompson and Jennifer Jason Leigh and then Tuva Novotny. So they all have to kind of go in there, and it's one of these expedition movies. It reminded me a little bit of Alien in some ways.
That's, speaking of DNA which, is clearly
speaking
there.
Speaking of which, Chris Klimek, my Alien go-to guy.
Well, that influence is certainly felt along with a lot of other sort of semi-schlocky early 80s horror sci-fi, like the John Carpenter remake of The Thing, I think is clearly one of the forebears of this movie. I've liked Alex Garland's other films a lot. He had a long career as a screenwriter before he started directing. He wrote 28 Days Later and Sunshine. I think this movie is an amalgamation of a lot of things that I like. And this is the rare film that I will sort of point to as something that shows the development of inexpensive digital effects as a good thing, because there's no way that a movie that cost a lot of money could do this, because they don't explain very much. I think the tendency towards over-explanation is a real weakness in genre films. You know, I was here pretty recently talking about this current season of Black Mirror and the episode Metalhead, which just drops us into this world and doesn't tell us anything about how that happened. We get a little more table setting here. We actually get, by way of summary, what sounds like the first line of a song, if I may. The shimmer is a prism that refracts DNA. You can just, imagine that sort of continuing on in Schoolhouse Rock fashion at the beginning of each episode.
It sounds like a They Might Be Giants.
It does. It has a nice, I don't know if it's iambic pentameter, but the scansion of that phrase is just perfect.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we should finish the song. I don't know. I'm kind of still processing. I think the novelty, and I'm sad that it is still a novelty, but seeing a film like this cast almost entirely with women is great. That makes it a lot more interesting than it might be otherwise. Natalie Portman is like an actor who I've never found that compelling, and I don't really understand why. I certainly don't think there's any weakness in her technique or anything. But that was sort of balanced out for me by the abundance of other interesting women.
Yeah. What'd you think, Daisy?
I want to say I enjoyed it, but enjoy also still feels like the wrong word. It kind of gets in you in a way that I think is really interesting and that I think is true of Alex Garland's other work, not just the screenwriting. I actually think I'm thinking less of the screenwriting, but if I think of specifically of Ex Machina and then the book he wrote, which is The Beach, they made a movie of it with Leonardo DiCaprio. Do not think of the movie, but specifically the book. I have had very kind of bizarre emotional reactions to each of those, and I would say it was similar with this. Maybe not as intense, but I would definitely agree with Chris that it benefits from not trying to over-explain what's happening. But I mean, with The Beach, I read that book, and at the end of the book, I felt such an ick with the book. I mean, the physical book. I couldn't be in the room with the physical book. I threw it in a guest room and closed the door, right? And then Ex Machina.
It's like Joey on Friends putting his scary book in the freezer.
Yeah, like, you know, like
buried it in the backyard.
Exactly. I was so, like, thrown by how I felt from that book. And then with Ex Machina, similarly, I got into, like, a weird fight with the person I was dating after because we were just both, like, our heads were not in the best place. And so with this movie, it wasn't as intense, but it did at least let me know that I'm continuing to be interested in this person's work, and I like that he didn't try to provide too many answers, and I still got that feeling, but I was able to walk home through a dark street without losing it. So that's
I'm surprised.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I just want to express my condolences on you breaking up with Oscar Isaac after I brief, but hopefully,
you know,
fulfilling.
People always question how I could have let that go.
Anyway, I think, you know, for me, what made this movie interesting is that I will always take a creepy movie over a scary movie. Mm. And as weird as the Darren Aronofsky film Mother got
at
the end, the first half of it to me, which is just unsettling in all of these ways, I really enjoyed because the creeping dread of it was so effective. And I think there are a lot of places in the first, you know, even the first 80% of this film that are just unsettling in a way that I thought was very effective. There's an early scene in which Natalie Portman and Oscar Isaac are talking, and there's a glass of water that's used in a certain way in the shot that's just odd. It gives the whole thing a kind of an off-balance feel visually. And I loved the creepy parts of it, the way in which it just seems to get more and more strange and mysterious, honestly mysterious in a straightforward way. One of the things I also like about it is that it fakes a couple times toward becoming a more conventional. Mm-hmm. There's a moment when you think it's going to be, you know, a sci-fi TV sci-fi network movie about a cross between, you know, one scary animal and another scary animal. But it's not that. It's just sort of faking in that direction that it's going to be a what's the lurking monster. And it never is going to go in that direction. I am not always a sucker for the kind of very dreamy, ethereal set piece ending that this film has. Mm. It has a sequence at the end, you know, that like the end of a film like 2001 or the ballet at the end of An American in Paris is kind of set apart in a way from the rest of the film. I don't always like that kind of thing because sometimes it feels to me like the filmmaker showing off. But I liked the fact that for a lot of the way through this film, you can understand it on a pretty literal level. And it only really goes for that feeling fairly close to the end.
Sure. I do think, you know, you mentioned the hybrid animals. This movie does a really nice job of taking a scary thing where you're trying to figure out what the scary thing even is, and still at the same time finding ways to very often make that scary thing beautiful. There's a very disturbing scene where ultimately you see a corpse where, like, basically a gigantic kind of flower monster, I guess, has kind of grown out of it.
Please, Stephen, arboreal people.
On one hand, you're like, ew, it's a body. And on the other hand, you're like, that looks like nothing I've ever seen before.
Yeah.
And the use of color in this movie, you're seeing a lot of mutated plants. At one point, you're seeing kind of trees made of ice crystals almost. And you just have all this weird stuff to look at. And it does such a nice job because the team is venturing further and further into this Bermuda Triangle, as you said, Linda. They're able to gradually immerse you in a weirder and weirder world where at first you're just kind of seeing like, wow, that's a bright and unusual looking group of flowers. And as they go along, it gets weirder and more menacing. I just loved the look of this movie. It is very, very inventively crafted from a visual standpoint.
Yeah. And I think it is intentionally playing with that horrifying, beautiful kind of balance throughout.
Which I think Ex Machina does as well. I know you haven't seen that movie, Linda, but it does play in that way. It's visually well composed. What they've put together is beautiful. And at the same time, there's this creep. There's this ick. There are these moments where you're seeing things that you're not that you're not supposed to see, but that you feel like you're not supposed to see or that you shouldn't see.
Yeah, Ex Machina was a rich source of GIFs. This movie will be a rich source of screensavers, maybe.
Yeah.
Oscar Isaac dances a lot less in this movie.
It's true.
I'm sorry.
But I think the other thing that's interesting about it is you have this team of women who are working together-ish, you know?
Well.
And they all are really...
Sundays on ABC.
They all are really making these specific choices about what the character is supposed to be. I think the Jennifer Jason Leigh, when I first saw how she was kind of presenting this character, I thought, that's an interesting choice, right? Because you know, you've seen Jennifer Jason Leigh in a lot of things. You know she can do whatever she wants. This is the choice they made for this character. And similarly, I think Tessa Thompson, it's a very different kind of energy for her because I'm used to thinking of her as this kind of luminous woman in Creed and in Thor, where
she's basically Han Solo.
Right. She's kind of bookish. I think it's a really interesting career choice for her. And you mentioned how unusual it is to see a film like this populated mostly by women. One of the options that gives, people talk a lot about lead roles, but it's also really nice to see a movie with a lot of good supporting roles that allow an actor like Tessa Thompson or Gina Rodriguez.
So different from Jane the Virgin. Yes.
So different. Our producer, Jessica Reedy, and I were talking on the way home about the fact that every time you hear her swear, you kind of go, Jane, oh my goodness. This character is a little more butch and a lot more than what people are used to seeing from her. One of the things that you get from a film that has a lot of women in it, it's not just the big lead roles, it's the supporting roles that let people continue to expand their film careers.
They also do a lot more than just fend off beasties. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, a wonderful scene in this movie where there's just a discussion about the difference between basically like suicidal ideology and self-destructive tendencies. Because these people are on what many would call a suicide mission, they actually stop and analyze that and you know, whether it's a sense of duty or a sense of you have nothing to lose or a sense of you're trying to make up for something. They spent time not necessarily dwelling on the backstories of the characters so much as just talking about the idea of the kind of sacrifices and risks that these people are taking. Yeah. And I think that makes it a much richer horror movie in the sense that it's a horror movie.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that moment really works, and it was something I thought about a lot later in the sense that it doesn't feel like it is just some kind of statement for the film of like, this is the thing you've been waiting for and this is the question that we're trying to answer. It feels like a question that, one, you should have as an audience member if you're really thinking about what they're doing, and that they put out there and they try to grapple with a little bit, but they're not trying to give you any particular solid answer. And I think that's actually an example of where this movie succeeds versus things like, you know, say some of the M. Night Shyamalan movies really fail is because he's trying to give you some really crazy definitive answer. You know, I kept thinking of like The Happening and how he's like, I'm talking on a level you don't get. And it's like, nah, dude, you're laying it out so clearly and poorly. Whereas like, this is like understanding the questions that the human psyche might come up with and asking you to grapple with them, but not giving you an answer and letting you sit in that.
You don't have to look at the film and say, this is nothing that anyone else has ever tried to do. It's you say, well, this is something that's really hard to do well, and it's done really well in this film, is that balance of styles and elements and things.
Yes.
And one thing I wanted to mention to Stephen before we go is I was interested in the fact that they went with like acoustic guitars as the musical framework. I mean, you have the kind of wah, 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 wah music, but you also have these like...
The shimmer is a prism.
But you also have these kind of acoustic guitar licks that make it feel indie band scored almost.
I think that really reflects the look and feel of this movie, though. Like, one of the things that they're doing is they're walking through what is essentially like a beautiful, uncharted land. And when you walk through the shimmer, I mean, the shimmer is this almost heavenly construct. And so you want some of the music to capture kind of the beauty of nature as well as, and there is also a lot of that kind of inception-y, blah, you know, there's a lot of portent and abrasion in the score as well.
That's a good phrase.
There's a juxtaposition all over this movie of different sounds. And I think that's part of what makes it effective.
Yeah. And another thing I think we should talk about is that the Natalie Portman character here, not in the first book, but in the second book, it's established that she has some Asian ancestry and that the Jennifer Jason Leigh character has some Native American ancestry. So, you know, it raises this issue of whitewashing in a way that I think is really interesting because, you know, Garland has pretty clearly said he was only working off the first book and it really varies a lot from that book. But it raises a really interesting question about people have raised it as a whitewashing issue. And it's a tough one.
Yeah, it is always a tough one. I mean, look, that's a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. You're hearing my voice, but I'm Afro-Latina and you don't know it. Mm-hmm. I care a lot about that. And I do think that one, yeah, like the first book was what was out when Alex Garland optioned the book to create a script from it. So he was working with that. But having seen the movie, not only is it well cast with a main cast that features actresses like Gina Rodriguez and Tessa Thompson, but he did something that is just the tiny thing that I wish so many other directors would do, even in a movie that has white stars because the characters are supposed to be white, is the rest of that world is populated with all kinds of real people, not just people of color, people that make sense for where they are. So in the brief moments that we see Natalie Portman at the university that she teaches at, in the moments that we see her in the holding place that she's in, what's the word for that?
The isolation.
Yeah. You know,
quarantine.
The doctors, the students, it represents a real and diverse world. And that to me is actually something that drives me crazy is when you can make the rest of the world look like the rest of the world and you don't.
Yeah.
So while that is a good question, I think, you know, when somebody shows good faith like that in other ways, I can give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, I think that's a fair take. And we do want to hear what all of you think about Annihilation. It's a head scratcher. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from MasterClass, producing online classes taught by masters of their craft. Each class is shot with cinematic production quality and offers on-demand lessons loaded with exclusive content. Classes include Gordon Ramsay teaches cooking, Annie Leibovitz teaches photography, Steph Curry teaches basketball, and more. Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners can unlock every class with the new All Access Pass, available now at masterclass.com/happyhour. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the new Surface Pro from Microsoft. It's a laptop built for speed with a battery life that lasts all day, so you can play up to 13.5 hours of video without needing to charge. It's light enough to go anywhere you want with options for a removable keyboard in lots of new colors. Its touchscreen display responds to your fingertips with great resolution too. And it also works with your iPhone. The new Surface Pro is the lightest, most powerful Surface Pro ever.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Whenever I've needed to settle my brain, and I've needed to settle my brain quite a bit lately, I've been watching a lot of random Olympics coverage. And I wanted to call people's attention, if they haven't seen it, to a performance on the halfpipe where they're skiing
Freestyle skiing.
Yeah. The performance of a skier on the Hungarian team named Elizabeth Swainy. Elizabeth Swainy is an American, but she has Hungarian grandparents. But she managed to somehow get on the Hungarian Olympic team and make it to the Olympics as a very, very average skier.
There's a whole story about how she did it.
There's a great story actually on the NPR site that Here and Now worked on that I do recommend. We'll throw in a link to it. But basically, when you watch the footage of Elizabeth Swainy on the halfpipe, she's just going zip, zip, zip. Zip. And you think when you start the link and people are like, you have to check out this performance, you think you're going to see like spectacular spills. You think what you're going to see is like me on the half pipe, you know, like wiping out and then just like spiraling down the hill. There's something about the humor of the thoroughly unremarkable juxtaposed against these announcers trying to make it interesting enough, at least to say something. And at one point, kind of early on, they're like, doesn't really have very many tricks. But they can't just say, like, what is she doing here? What are we watching? It's so weirdly fun. It's also just part of an Olympic story that I enjoy, which is kind of like the shirtless Tongan who was in the cross-country race and came in like 114th out of like 119, and all the last place finishers who've been on skis for 3 months, that's the length of the race for them, where they're like hugging, and that spirit of community is something.
Here's to the losers.
Here's to the losers, man. I just eat that stuff up with a spoon, but there's just something about watching that lady just go, vroom, vroom. She's not glumping around. She's a perfectly decent skier.
I couldn't do it.
I could not do it at all. So anyway, Elizabeth Swaney on the Olympic halfpipe.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
All right, I have two. I'll be quick. One of them is a making of book about a film mentioned in this conversation previously. It is Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, which makes the formula no script, unlimited budget look good. Mm-hmm. Unlike every other example of this formula. Michael Benson, on April 3rd, the 50th anniversary of the release of this film, which we'll be celebrating with a bunch of events at the National Air and Space Museum, has done a really thorough, deeply researched, roughly 400-page history of the 4 years that when Kubrick and the science fiction novelist Arthur C. Clarke were making this movie and sort of fighting amongst themselves creatively. This is a really nice balance between the sort of great man of history, brilliant artist kind of, I wouldn't say hagiography in this case, because it does present Kubrick for the absolute bastard that he could be to his collaborators. But it is fascinating. I mean, I think the movie, you know, it is a historic document. It's one of the most important films of all time. And seeing how something that has had that long shadow over cinema for 50 years came out of endless, just incredibly prosaic, basic conversations that just have not a trace of magic in them, you know, budgets, schedules, everyday stuff. I don't know. I find that kind of inspiring in a way. You think the minutiae of your life doesn't even have the potential to add up to something monolithic. Maybe it can. So that book is Michael Benson's Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. The other thing is a post that appeared on Slate this week by me, documenting, it is called, Does Black Panther Say Vibranium As Much As Avatar Says Unobtainium?
All right. Nice. I'm going to let people find it and find out what your verdict was.
Shocking results.
Chris is
it's not my verdict. It's math, Linda.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. Daisy Rosario, what is making you happy this week?
You know, with the release of Black Panther and with you've got all of these kids from this high school that have gone through this traumatic event. Last weekend was actually an incredible weekend for really powerful, bald, brown women. I was reminded of this not only through that, but also because of the NBA All-Star Halftime Show, which featured the band NERD, which is a group that I like and whose most recent album came out around the new year. And I was listening to it a lot. So NERD is, you know, like one of Pharrell's many projects. I just really enjoy kind of their weird music, and you never know when they're going to drop an album. They just kind of do it in between Pharrell doing 8 million other things. So yeah, it just felt like the world was trying to show me just kind of how amazing, beautiful, brown, bald women could be, you know, between Black Panther and then that video that went viral of that student who survived the awful shooting in Florida, Emma Gonzalez. You know, at this point, I think we've seen a lot of the students be very outspoken, but she's kind of the girl who went viral. She was the one saying, we call BS. And I know I saw that blowing up on the internet over the weekend. And then I turn on the NBA All-Star game, and right smack in the middle, you've got this beautiful bald woman, this dancer for Pharrell for a long time, just taking center stage and doing a solo. And it reminded me of this album, which is in its own way kind of fun and very oddly political for a band that is never political. It is a very kind of fun, silly side project. I've been listening to them since, I want to say, like 2002, and that's never been their MO. So it really reminded me of the album and made me revisit it, and I'm back on it, and you should check it out.
Thank you very much, Daisy Rosario.
Thank you.
So what is making me happy this week is a trash diversion. I've said this before, I often come in with a new binge watch after I've been cleaning my apartment. And this time it is Million Dollar Listing New York, which is a Bravo show in which very rich real estate brokers deal with extraordinarily rich clients, and everyone is a terrible person. It's a little bit like Real Housewives, except that it does not rely so much on stereotypes about women being unreasonable and fighting. It more just involves business and money and people being horrible monsters about apartments in New York that cost $12 million and arguing about whether they should cost $12 million or $13 million, which means that the rage that builds in me when I watch some of these horrible people is aimed at income inequality and extraordinary wealth. And I feel good about that. I don't feel good about the circumstances that create those apartments that cost $12 million. I love my own rage in those moments. All of my rage I consider virtuous.
It feeds you.
It feeds me. And that is what is making me happy this week. Million Dollar Listing New York.
Rage.
Please don't watch now. Give it a watch if you want to be super angry about the society in which you live. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can find me at NPR Monkey C. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Daisy at Run DMR and Chris at CT Klimek. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have a minute and you're so inclined, please throw us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people to find the show. We will be right back here next week.